Welcome to the DevCon Archives, featuring top sessions from the latest DevCon, which took place in Bangkok in November 2024. These episodes spotlight some of the best talks from the largest Ethereum developer conference, showcasing the technical advancements, mission, projects, and novel ideas shaping the Ethereum ecosystem. All talks have been recorded. You can find them on archive.devcon.org. Let's dive into today's featured talk.
Really excited to be here. I missed the Bogota one. I was in the Osaka one, so happy to be back at DEF CON. Thank you. And today's talk is Plurality, Infinite Diversity in Infinite Combinations. You can read all about it at plurality.net, which is a public domain book. Now, as you have seen in the trailer, The Good End of Ancestor, back in 2014, just a decade ago, Taiwan was facing a real public trust problem. The trust in the democratic administration was as high as 9%, which was not very high. And the society was very polarized and very angry, energies everywhere. And so the point that we made back then was that we should not succumb to the anger and outrage that swept across much of the world at the time. And instead, we should turn conflict into co-creation. And there's a saying that says, to give no trust is to get no trust. And in the span of just 6 years, we had rebuilt the trust by radically trusting the people. And so by 2020, the public trust has risen to over 70%. And so this is the journey that began a decade ago. The Sunflower Movement, March 2014, was when people were really deeply unhappy about how the administration and the parliament was handling a particular trade negotiation. But what set this movement apart is that we said that we're not protesters. Protesters is against something. We're demonstrators. Demonstrators build alternatives. So we occupied peacefully the parliament for 3 weeks with 500,000 people on the street and many more online. And the occupied streets around the parliament became a live open citizen assembly. Anybody can come there and learn about how exactly does the trade agreement affect them. And they can engage in a facilitated conversation, both in person and online. And every day we reach a little bit consensus about those specific issues and read them aloud. And after 3 weeks, something very rare happened in the history of Occupies. The Speaker of the Parliament accepted all our demands. And so that was extraordinary. And by the end of 2014, the central government invited us, the civic activists, to join the cabinet as reverse mentors, advising the cabinet in the art of how to rebuild public trust. And so the idea, the key idea here, is bridging systems. The first thing we did in 2015 was building such bridging systems, online platforms, that mirror the facilitated dialogues that we had during the occupation. For example, this is a real screenshot back in 2015 about Uber, which involved non-professional drivers and which really offended the taxi drivers, caused a lot of conflict both in the street and online. But instead of letting the discussion devolve into outrage on social media, we built our own pro-social media where citizens can express their views constructively, and this is the Polis platform. It's an open source platform where people can propose ideas, like insurance is very important for ride sharing and so on. And as you can see, there's this agree button and disagree button, but there's no reply button. With no reply button, there's no room for trolls to grow. And you can see as you click agree or disagree that your avatar, that blue circle, moves toward to a cluster, a K-means cluster, where people share with your views. And you can see what binds you together and what are dividing the groups. And the idea here is that we focus on the bridging idea. The more an idea bridge across groups, the more bonus it gets. And so only the idea that speaks to all the different groups can get agenda setting power to be part of the policy agenda. And so during the Uber deliberation, people first agree on the basic facts, like what's actually happening. And then we ask, how do you feel about those facts? And some were angry, some were, you know, happy, but everybody is an expert in their own feelings. And this allowed us to cluster based on the shared sentiments. And so by the third week, we had a set of very bridging ideas, like surge pricing is acceptable while the demand is high, but undercutting meters is not. And so the final regulations setting these as agenda ensure fairness for both Uber and the local cooperatives in rural areas and so on. And so the lesson we learned back in 2015 was that polarization is not a function of the people involved, it is a function of the space. And so we can design pro-social systems that reduce polarization as a function of the space, making the group informed consensus into a common knowledge, like a group selfie that everybody sees and say, oh, actually we do agree with most of our neighbors most of the time on most of the points, and it's just one or two things that divides us. And that group selfie is very powerful. Now, the idea has since then influenced the mainstream platforms such as Twitter, now X.com, and also YouTube. So maybe some of you have tried the jury duty, that is the community notes. It follows the same principle. So if only one side on the left, on the right, agree with a note, it does not get featured. It only gets featured if it bridges perspective from both sides, encouraging more and more balanced contributions. And so by promoting those notes that bridge differences, the system incentivizes this idea of constructive engagement. And so more generally, while the social media connects us globally, it often treats the individuals as isolated units, and prioritizing that engagement, that dopamine hit, over genuine connection. And so instead of these efforts to exploit our social fabric rather than regenerating it, we can do better. And the polis community nodes are just prototypes to what we call pro-social systems. And the main idea of pro-social systems, or plural systems, as Vitalik wrote in his blog, is to treat the connections between individuals as first-class objects. And that means designing platforms that recognize and enhance the relationship by naming the relationships and featuring them as part of the group selfie. And so transparency is really key, because many platforms already understand the networks that we belong to and the interests that we share, but the information is concealed from individual users and exploited for personalized, targeted advertising. And so by openly labeling those content with the community that it connects us to, whether cultural, professional, or social, we can empower the people to engage much more meaningfully. And so this idea has many applications, and in the book we discuss a lot of them, but basically all of them falls into this trade-off, this production possibility frontier. As you can see on one side, deep collaboration happens in small, in homogeneous groups, while large-scale interactions tend to be more superficial, like just capitalism. But what if we can push the frontier forward? And so that is the main research agenda for plural systems. What if we can design systems that allows for the same deep, meaningful collaboration, but across larger groups? Or we keep the same scale of people engaged, but much more meaningful, much more higher bandwidth democracy. And so by designing spaces that accommodates this kind of infinite combinations in infinite diversity, we can then move toward a much more interconnected society and tackling more and more emerging challenges. So I'll just use one example, which is the middle, the augmented deliberation. More recently, we tackled in Taiwan this March a society-wide issue, which is an emerging issue called deepfakes and other synthetic content on social media. And so this March, we sent out 200,000 random text messages, SMS, to citizens across Taiwan from 111, which is a well-known number that says this comes from the government, so you know it's not scam. And it asked a very simple question: how do you feel about information integrity online? And from those who responded, who said, okay, I'm willing to engage in online augmented deliberation, we randomly selected 450 people through random stratified sampling or sortition, a microcosm of our society in terms of age, occupation, region, so on and so forth. And so this microcosm were divided into 45 online rooms with 10 people each. And instead of professional facilitators, the room now auto-facilitates. The AI-powered tools guides the discussions without a human facilitator, and the platform transcribes the real-time transcripts, conversations, key points, points of disagreement, points of agreement, and even encourage the quieter participant to share their thoughts more. And so the AI-assisted deliberation enables us to scale meaningful conversations in real time and synthesize different ideas from those 45 different rooms into a coherent bridging idea that we then read out to the 450 people during the plenary. For example, one consensus that was woven this way was that social media platforms need to be liable if they fail to verify the mandatory digital signatures of online advertisements. In other words, if an advertisement shows Audrey Tang selling you some scam or something, and the platform did not secure a digital signature from me, and somebody get conned for $1 million, then that platform should be liable for $1 million. And so we took those collective insights, and within just 3 months, just passed the legislation with the support of all the different parties. And so the new law requires social media to ensure the authenticity in online advertisements, so it's not content-level moderation or censorship, but rather at actor-level provenance. And so this process demonstrated how technology can enhance democratic participation, turning this complex challenge, and basically deliberate in the same speed as the technology evolves. And so our journey in Taiwan taught that if we, instead of broadcasting, just broad listening from the society, we can just integrate those very different conflicts, polarized sides, and turn them into co-creation. It's not just limited to Taiwan. For example, in Japan this year, a young political newcomer, an AI researcher named is Takahiro Ano-san, embraced these principles after reading the Plurality book and ran for the Tokyo governor. And so inspired by the Plurality book, Ano-san basically used AI to deep fake himself. So he live streamed as a VTuber for 17 days, answering almost 10,000 questions from voters. You can call into a hotline to have a conversation with his voice clone. But the point is that it's all open source, and his manifesto, his platform is on GitHub. And so this kind of collaborative co-creation, again, show the people in Tokyo, like in real time, what they're preferred platforms are. And so Ano's experience basically illustrates how the principle of broad listening can result in a very high quality platform, independently rated as the best platform, even though he did not win, Koike-san won. But the idea is that we can enrich our collective experiences and weave a stronger, more interconnected social fabric. And so that leads to the idea of pro-social media. What you're seeing here is a prototype called Cortico.ai from MIT that exemplify the idea of pro-social media. And the software is to enable small gatherings like religious, community, educational settings to hold meaningful listening sessions. And the software, again, transcribes and anonymizes the conversations, highlighting the points where people resonate and share those resonating ideas across the bridging groups. And so this creates a network of understanding where insights from one group inform discussions in another group. And ultimately, a collective sense-making report is done, again, with the help of language models, and then reflecting the collective voice of the people so that people can then understand deeply what they all care about. And the idea of pro-social media then regenerate a social fabric rather than maximize individual engagement. And this can also offer a new revenue source because for communities and also for personal subscriptions, we all want to connect more meaningfully with our communities. And so this leads to the real world application part. So in our pursuit to do more pro-social digital environments, this year, there's also a very interesting critical opportunity. So one of the world's most influential social networks is called TikTok. And we think rather than resorting to bans, we're putting together what's called a people's bid to acquire the US assets of TikTok and turn it into exactly that sort of pro-social constructive communities-driven space. As you can see, TikTok's recommendation algorithm has been a double-edged sword. Last year, there's research that shows an average undergrad in the US, if you want them to stop using TikTok, you have to pay them $60 or so a month for the utility that's lost. But if there is a way for them to make everybody around them including themselves, quit TikTok. They're willing to pay like $30 US per month. And so this is a kind of collective trap situation where people find it very difficult to leave due to the network effects and peer pressure. And so the People's Bid basically seeks to acquire TikTok US and shift it into the open decentralized infrastructure, not unlike Farcaster or Lens, and allowing users to port their social graphs and choose their own experiences. So there's no immediate lose. If you migrate away from one particular front end, you can keep all the values in the network. And so by replacing the existing recommendation engines with bridge-making algorithms, we hope to promote content that fosters understanding and collaboration across those diverse different viewpoints. And research from Stanford already showed that such bridge-making algorithms can maintain the same user engagement while enhancing the quality of interactions and overall mental well-being. So if you know someone from the Web3 space who would like to architect TikTok's eventual migration to the decentralized social networking protocol, like a CTO for the People's Bid, please do get in touch. So now, before moving to the Q&A, with 10 minutes left, I'd like to share something personal. Back in 2016, when I was first named digital minister in Taiwan, Taiwan did not have a digital minister before. And so the HR asked me, would you like to write a job description to describe what a digital minister do? And in Taiwan, it just so happens, Shu Wei means both digital and plural. So in addition to being a digital minister, I'm also a minister of plurality. And so what follows is really a prayer. It is my job description as digital minister and now cyber ambassador of Taiwan. It goes like this. When we see the Internet of Things, let's make it an Internet of Beings. When we see virtual reality, let's make it a shared reality. When we see machine learning, let's make it collaborative learning. When we see user experience, let's make it about human experience. And whenever we hear that a singularity is near, let us always remember the plurality is here. Thank you so much. Any questions, thoughts, ideas, comments? Well, feel free to get in touch. I'm at Audrey T on most platforms. Thank you. Oh, there's a question there. Sorry. Yes. Please.
Thank you. Really great talk. Yes, I was just really interested with the experiments that you've run, like if you ever have trouble with people engaging and if you've explored different kind of incentive mechanisms to get people involved in all this great work and research.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so the key to get people engaged is fast, fair, and fun. Fast meaning that you need to offer a kind of instant gratification. So for example, in Taiwan, even for people under 18, anyone who secured the signature online for 5,000 people can kind of force a ministerial response within just 60 days at most. And so it encouraged people, like according to the ICC as the International Citizenship and Civic Education Standard, the Taiwanese 15 years olds are top of the world when it comes to the feeling that they have the agency, that they can change the society. And we publicize the results, which could be fun. You know, one of the results early on was banning plastic straws from the bubble tea takeouts, the boba takeouts that was very successful, started by a 16-year-old. By the time she was 17, she became a cabinet-level reverse mentor. There's also another very popular petition that says we would like to go to school 1 hour later because study shows that 1 more hour of sleep actually, as opposed to 1 more hour of study, actually increased the grades. And the Ministry of Education was like, yeah, that's a great idea. And so that was passed and included into law. And so by publicizing, yeah, it really is science. 1 more hour of sleep does help study. So by making sure that we publicize those early wins, those quick wins, we make sure that people who have like otherwise longer term, you know, planning thresholds and so on, can get the support. Like a 16-year-old and 17-year-old, they can get the support from 60 years old and 70 years old because both have more time on their hands and care more about the long-term sustainability anyway. And so each even partial or failed petition then builds the community that pushes the next petition forward. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions? There's quite a few there.
Thank you.
Thank you for the talk.
I'm a huge fan of your work. Thank you for that.
Sorry for the mutex semaphore.
Okay. We can ask
coordination
questions.
Yes. Yeah. Please.
Okay. So again, I'm a huge fan of your work. Thank you for that. But while we try to use what you suggest in Web3, my question is, what would be your call to action, like a wider call to action for mm-hmm. all of us, also mm-hmm. outside Web3? Because it seems like it needs like a huge leap from where we are to those new systems that can, you know, stop the world from falling apart. Thank you.
Great. The most interesting experiments early on that I saw in quadratic voting, quadratic funding, this kind of high bandwidth plural systems, they all started in Web3 space and mostly from the Ethereum ecosystem. Basically, what we use in Taiwan, either for the presidential hackathon or quadratic funding, we basically look at the Ethereum ecosystem, see what worked, and then took what worked and in the real world applications. So although I guess it's not strictly speaking real world application of Ethereum, it's real world application with Ethereum. Nowadays, I think with the newfound superpowers of Ethereum to settle the transactions and so on so quickly, I am thinking that most people who want to build such pro-social system, who want the social graph to persist in a way that transcends individual experiences and so on, they now see like what we just saw from the Sony and the Sony L2 idea. We can take existing traditional institutions, centralized institutions like TikTok, and then offer some sort of a ramp so that it become decentralized and then bridging into the existing very exciting decentralized social systems. So I think that sort of conversion, the Web3 to like Web2 ramp and offering a kind of an easy ramp for the Web2 people to come aboard, I think that is one very exciting opportunity that I can see. But keep doing the experiments of the bridging bonuses and so on in the Web3 world, because after all, for a policymaker, like pointing to anywhere in the world where something worked is a sure way to get it into the standard and consciousness of people. So keep up the good work. Okay.
Question. Do you see the innovations that you've been working on in Taiwan on democratic systems? Are they merely a better way of manufacturing consent? Mm-hmm. Or is it possible that at some point we evolve beyond the need for hierarchical structures? Mm-hmm. So a direct democracy could actually lead to better decisions within the right coordinating structures?
That's a great question. Indeed, I think currently the examples I gave is more like in design thinking terms, it's like in the first diamond. It is about discovering the common values and defining how those values should be applied to solve an emerging issue. But in existing representative democracy, the second diamond, which is the development of the budgets and policies and the delivery of such things in the execution layer, in the administration, these stay the same. So basically, this is like a add-on to the existing representative democracy. But we do also see, for example, during the pandemic or the infodemic, the disinformation crisis during the pandemic, we do see that there are certain functions that people in Taiwan do not want the government to run, for example, fact-checking. They would think that if you centralize the authority of fact-checking into something that's run by the government, then the government has an incentive of basically saying things that are from the opposition party as false or something. So in Taiwan, we do not actually concentrate that power into the administration, but rather rely on the collaborative fact-checking in the civil society, on the open source ecosystem, so that, for example, Facebook or Instagram, the Meta ecosystem, they partner with the Taiwan Fact-Checking Center or the MyGoPen or the Collaborative Fact-Checking System, and these are in the social sector. These are in the civil society, and we make sure in the government that we just offer like very quick responses to the fact-checkers instead of assuming the function ourselves. So I think the more practical way to think about it is to feel in a society whether there are some functions that people just do not want the government to centralize. And from those fields, we can then use the same coordination measures and then extend to the development and the delivery layers. And once people have good peak experience, like the society-wide deliberation, and then we can piggyback on those experience and then expand more for direct democracy or participatory democracy. But it needs to be done piecemeal instead of just assuming all the governmental functions before the grassroots, the civic muscles are ready. Thank you. Great question. Yes.
Hey. So my question kind of connects to direct democracy, like the last question. And if I had to make an analogy on the on your kind of spiel and idea, is that we're trying to migrate realities. So we're trying to migrate from a physical reality to something that is more virtual, governed by bits and bytes, maybe later other things. But physical reality has a fabric which is very basic. There's one person, one vote, and that kind of governs morality in some way, right? So how are you trying to migrate that? Because physical reality has bad actors, and bad actors can exploit the lack of fabric that you have, that you don't have in virtual realities. Namely, it's called Sybil, stability or anything like that. So what, I'm curious to understand what you're thinking about that.
So just to clarify the question is that in physical reality, like each person is physically in one space, it is impossible for me to fork into like 10,000 clones or robotic clones. And
it has been like that for thousands of years. So that's my question, basically. Yeah. How do you migrate that principle, which is physical, to something that is virtual?
Yeah. So, for example, in the polis system or the systems that we run, we of course need to ensure that each person only have one presence in that system. We usually use SMS, which works domestically because it's, if you try to get like 5,000 SMS numbers, the anti-money laundering people discover you very quickly. But beyond the borders, it is then the need for some sort of interoperable like personhood credentials, the ways to kind of disclose that you are not a bot without overly disclosing anything about yourself, that becomes very important. I think a couple of days ago, Finland is now running a hackathon that tries to solve this sort of problem because they want to use polis as their society-wide public digital infrastructure. And so they don't want, like Finns overseas, to have a lot of trouble authenticating, but they also don't want people being able to impersonate 10,000 people. And so they used exactly the same toolkit that you're all developing here, the zero knowledge proofs, the selective disclosure, verifiable credentials, and things like that. And so it's not to make the virtual world a surveilled world or a world where it's like real name transactions, but rather just to preserve one single feature from the physical world, which is one person can only be physically in one room at a time. So that is the feature that we're trying to imitate in the virtual world without making it into a surveillance capitalism space. So I'm not exactly sure that to completely address your question, but that is like the number one issue we face when we deploy that in the real world. Any other questions? Yes, one more question, okay.
Hello,
hey.
And thank you for your talk. It's inspirational, quite. If I can put this question together, I'd ask, what's the biggest threat from state actors against radical change and civic movement? Like, what do you think we can do about governments trying to subvert their own societies in the way that you've spoken?
Yeah, I think the number one threat that I see is this sense of the society being so polarized that any sort of organization or mobilization or trust is impossible. So it is in an authoritarian government's best interest to make sure that each individual feel like an individual and not at all horizontally connected, not at all participating in anything that's meaningful and change-making. And so to counter that, a lot of the work that we've been doing is to ensure that even at a very small community grassroots level, there are ways to quickly see that we do actually agree on common actions and can make those common actions together. Indeed, back in 2014, in the Occupy Parliament in Taiwan, all the different corners in Taiwan were occupied by different NGOs, the civil society organizations that has been around even when Taiwan was under the martial law, was a dictatorship, and they did not have the canvas to tackle like overtly political topics back then. Maybe they tackled like consumer right protection or environmental protection or collective buying, like cooperatives and so on. But after a few decades, the relationship muscles and civic muscles grew to a point where people do feel that they're in it together. And then they effected a peaceful transition to democracy in Taiwan and also ensure that it's not violent, because at any given time, people belong to intersection groups of civil society actors that they can feel that even though maybe the president wasn't yet directly elected, that didn't happen until 96, but throughout the 70s and 80s, more and more room gets opened by the civil society actors. So to counter the pessimistic polarization or manufactured polarization, the easiest way is just to get organized and just trust each other, even on a small scale. Thank you. All right, thank you so much for the great questions. Live long and prosper. Thank you.
Thank you, Audrey. Thank you, Audrey. Amazing talk. Okay. With this, we actually are concluding the programming for this main stage. At this point, the stage will be closing down. It will actually be dividing into three stages, which will reopen in the afternoon for more programming. Starting in 24 minutes are more talks in other stages around here on the same level. So you have talks around, introduction to multilateral trade credit, set off an MPC, unchained capital allocation workshop, what's going on into the Pectra upgrade by Christine, and bridging TradFi and DeFi through Ethereum and EVM, a pathway to innovation. So check out those talks in those other stages. We'll need everyone to clear out of this stage so we can reset. And thank you all for joining us here this morning.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to visit archive.devcon.org to watch and listen to all the other DevCon talks. We look forward to seeing you next time.